this experience of catching up, which a little bit what we were just doing feels like to me. That's something that's been happening today in our house. Davis was away the last week of our vacation. He was at this conference in New Mexico and just had an incredible time down there. It's one of those experiences where, as a parent, when you hear your kid talking about something that they've done that's been good for them, you just feel filled up, you know. It's just awesome. Anyway, his flight got canceled in Minneapolis last night. He was supposed to get home last night, and he didn't get home until noon today. And just one of those, you know, travel debacles. And we just felt like, I mean, we've got things we've got to do. We've got this camp that we run starts next week, and so we're getting ready for that and unpacking and transitioning. And I really, what I think we all just wanted to do was sit around and hear stories, you know, just tell us some more. Tell us some more about what your week was like and to reconnect. And one of the things that he came home with was, he didn't have a lot of luggage. He was traveling pretty light, but one of the things he came home with was, like, his carry-on was, like, he busted a zipper on it because he couldn't fit all the new books in. You know, so this is pretty typical Davis, right? This is awesome, man. Delta gave me this $50 voucher for food because it had to stay overnight. You can spend it on anything at the airport. He's in Minneapolis. Like, there's a mall in there. There's a classic section in the bookstore. So he's like $10 worth of food and $40 worth of books. Anyway, it's very Davis. One of the things he brought home, though, is a book by a poet named Amy Newman called Dear Editor. And Ms. Newman, like many writers, is constantly submitting her work for publication. And there's a standard form for submission for publication. Dear Sir, Madame, and here's this work, and here's this self-addressed stamped envelope, and thanks for your consideration. And she just has written hundreds of these things as a published writer, right? And so she decided to write a book of poetry where each of the poems was, they're prose poetry, so they don't rhyme. You know, they're not kind of, then I went to the well, and then there was Adele, and, you know, like it's a totally different thing than that. Where each of the prose poetry pieces talked about a poem that's not in the book. It kind of references something that's not there. And the whole book is written up as a series of submissions to publishers. It's called Dear Editor. And each one of them starts, Dear Editor, and goes on from there. And it uses the metaphor of chess for a spiritual search. And they are just unbelievably good. And refreshing, and her work with language is just incredible. Anyway, I want to read you one of them because it kind of sets off into the rest of this. Dear Editor, please consider the enclosed poems for publication. They are from my manuscript, X equals Pawn Capture, a lyrical exploration of chess moves and the desire to know the world's inner workings in a language unencumbered by doubts. Any guesses? It's your rat.
My rat.
Yeah. Go ahead. The patron saint of chess is considered by many to be Teresa of Avila, but recent scholarship disputes this and instead considers the possibility that chess is a trick my own grandfather played on me while my grandmother cried in the kitchen into an apron I myself have invented for the purposes of this story. For when that pretty and agonized Saint Teresa saw the sacred, he showed himself to her in flecks and hints. A leg here, an arm there, the holy hokey-pokey, where my doubt is never completely satisfied. As far as I'm concerned, Teresa might have had a better chance of convincing the doubters if she had on her person at the time a Nokia 3650 phone with video playback, because evidence is everything. So then, of course, there would be those who said the whole series was photoshopped. But still, I would have loved to have seen it. And maybe to know for certain would eliminate doubt or wonder and would have explained the look on my grandmother's face when my grandfather came in the house with evasion and something I want to describe but cannot. Because it is not our privilege to understand the world, which is shown to us in such irritating dimensions and swatches, like the scratchy tweeds I would have preferred to the wrinkled handkerchiefs of my upbringing. Thank you for your consideration and for reading. I have enclosed a self-addressed stamped envelope and look forward to hearing from you. Sincerely, Amy Newman. Anyway, I've been able to spend a little bit of time with that particular one, and so maybe it strikes me in a different way, but when she writes about St. Teresa of Avila being the patron saint of chess, of course she's joking. But this idea that searching for God is like a game of chess, searching for the sacred, and what she says about this is, when that pretty and agonized St. Teresa saw the sacred, he showed himself to her in flecks and hints, a leg here, an arm there, the holy hokey pokey. That just stopped me absolutely dead in my tracks. I thought what I wanted to do this evening is what's been going on in our house all day. I want to catch you up a little bit on some of the flecks and hints of the sacred that have come my way in the last 3 weeks, and particularly the ones that have come by sitting around the campfire, which is an important part of camping for us. And one of those hints that felt really significant to me came from the fire itself. And that's sort of where I want to concentrate. I feel like in sitting around the campfire and looking into it, I have... Thanks. You just cover it right up with that if you want, Megan. That'll help it. Relax. And one of the things that kind of came to me was the thought that fire in itself is kind of a legitimate stand-in for God, a kind of a real move in this, what Newman calls the hokey pokey of how God is revealed to us. There's a few things about fire that made that feel like it was legit for me. And one is that fire is essential. We don't tend to think about this much. We need fire at all kinds of levels. A campfire now for most of us is a luxury, right? I mean, we have a campfire because we want to, because we feel like it. But that's not the history of fire. We live really far from this most days, but the reason for fire in our lives is all kinds of bottom of the pyramid things. It's things like light and heat, a way to cook things so we can eat. All of that's kind of removed from us by technology, but at the heart of all of that, it's about fire. That's kind of what's going on there. And so there's something about the essential nature of fire that felt to me like it made it a thing that spoke to me about God. And another thing about fire that helped it sort of hint to me about God was that it's really dynamic. The campfires that we made were pretty modest affairs. They weren't, you know, these massive barn burners. But they were still completely ablaze. They were, beyond a doubt, they were fires. And then we came home, and of course, we come home to a huge backlog of mail, right? And in our house, one of the things that means is there's... One of the kids came walking into the kitchen with their hands full and said, "Man, there's a lot of issues in McLean's here to read." And this is a cover photograph on one of them. It's a fascinating photograph. I don't know if there's any McLean's readers here, but just one of those photographs where you... Wrong place, right time. Right place, right time. What do you say about a photograph like that? It's the Lac-Mégantic train explosion with this figure of Christ. You know, it's his arms spread out in this just conflagration in the background. Well, that's a fire as surely as our campfires was a fire. And when I think about those two different examples, one of the things that I think about fire that speaks to me about the nature of God is it's dynamic. This fire is absolutely nothing like the fire that we were sitting around, but they're both fire. The thing we use the word fire for has an awful lot of different, if you want, faces to it. And to me, that feels like a reason, a good reason, that fire can speak to us about, hint to us, be a fleck of the revelation of God. And the other thing about fire is that it's mysterious. We can all make a fire, more or less, you know, some of us skillfully, some of us clumsily, but we'd get it going, you know, there'd be a fire. But we can't make the things we make fire with. It's really kind of curious. Science has given us all kinds of insight into what makes things burn. You know we need fuel, we need oxygen, we need a spark. We kind of got this understanding of a thing called fire that's about its bits, And it's easy to forget, given all that we know, that we can't replicate wood in the lab, that we can't make wood. It's too complex. And that's kind of interesting. We know what oxygen is comprised of, and we can bottle it, and we can transport it, but we can't make it from scratch, and yet we can't live without it. And when we make sparks, we're doing something derivative. We're assembling a smaller imitation of a big thing that occurs in the world around us without our assistance or our causation. We're imitating something we can't make. And in the end, what that all means is we can't make fire. So you kind of see how these things are shaping up to be a bit like God. It's kind of interesting. So maybe it shouldn't come as any kind of a great surprise that God's self chooses to appear in some of our own sacred stories in Christendom as fire. So we've kind of got God talking to Moses out of this blazing bush. We've got this pillar of fire in Exodus that provides guidance and light. And then the Old Testament prophets, they just seem to love using this poetic image of God's words coming from wherever they come from, but still ablaze, you know. And then in the New Testament, there's this image of the Spirit of God as fire, both in appearance as tongues of fire above the heads of the people when this new form of God comes to be with humanity. And John the Baptist has these compelling pictures he uses of Jesus coming to us with the Holy Spirit and with fire, whatever that means. And the imagery just kind of won't go away. It just kind of keeps popping up. So what happens if I take that idea a little bit further? What happens if I make the relationship between my search for God analogous to some of the ways that I would search for fire? Well, one of the things that happens inside my imagination right away is that I'm reminded that the essence of what I want is not something that I cause, but something that I seek. The thing that I most want when I want a fire. The thing that I most want when I want God, God's presence. Those are not things that I make happen. They're things that I look for. And that's a pretty important distinction. What I want, what I need when it comes to fire is a fire. I want something that is dynamic beyond my understanding to come into this constrained little space of my life, into a little fire pit in a campground. So I can sit beside it and I can be warm, so I can make s'mores with my kids and so I can enjoy their company, so I can muse about things that are beyond me. I want something from that fire. I don't want lac megantic. I don't want this. I don't want a conflagration. I don't want a disaster that takes away from me all the things that I hold dear. I want a little controlled version of the same thing, which is fire. And it's easy to forget that at its heart, the thing that I want in the campground and the thing that destroys this town are the same thing. It's easy to forget when I have a little version of it in my fire pit in the campground that that's what I'm looking at. But if I have to go to the bathroom, and I'm in BC at Mount Fernie Campground, which is a relatively primitive campground as far as services go, and I have to go use the outhouse, and I go in there, and I sit down, and I'm looking for something to read, because that's what you do, and you look at the door, and there's this nice little metal plaque screwed on there, and it's directions about what to do if my campfire, my little constrained campfire, turns into a conflagration. What should I do? It says in not so many words, take your family and run. But it also says don't panic. And it says assist the park staff if they ask you to, but don't go back for your car and don't go back for your stuff. It's interesting, eh? One of the delightful things about our camping trips the last couple of years has been the ways in which Tyrion and Taya, who are our youngest two kids, have become the fire makers. They've become the people in the family that just... that's their job. They're the ones who make the campfire. And they take this enormous delight in like splitting the kindling and building what they call the teepee out of the kindling. And just everything has to do with starting the fire and building the fire and keeping the fire going. And they just want to deal with it all without any assistance at all. In fact, they're kind of offended if anybody steps in and gets involved. And they're old enough now, the youngest two kids are, that this trip, for the first time, all the older people could be away on a bike ride, and Tyrion and Tay could be in campground, so safely on their own. And so this one morning, we were all off on a ride, and it was kind of the first time we'd done this, and Tyrion and Tay were really excited about us going and leaving them in charge of the whole place. And so they were like, you know, if you're going to go out and bike around the place, you know, you just be safe, you wear your helmet, you watch for cars, and you know, don't motor into people's campsites if there's actually people camped there. The empty ones are fine. And just have a great time, and we'll be, you know, back in 2 hours. And they were totally stoked. They had some kind of project in mind. So we took off. Well, in BC campgrounds, you have to buy firewood, right? In the provincial campgrounds, they don't provide it free like they do here in Manitoba, in a lot of campgrounds, and so that's what we've been doing. Well, by the time we got back, this was a morning ride, by the time we got back around noon, they had this little mountain of firewood stacked up in our campsite. And they had just waited till people pulled out of their campsites, checked out, and they just went and saw if they'd left any firewood behind. And if they had, they scavenged it, and found a way to get it back to our campsite on their bikes. And they'd entertained half the campground with their innovation about how to carry firewood on a bicycle. But anyway, so we had this little mountain of firewood. They're just into this, right? This is their thing. They like to build the fire, but they don't always agree about the details of how it should be built, and they don't always build it. The two of them don't build it the same. They have their own way of doing this thing. But in the end, we have a fire. We have this essential, mysterious, dynamic thing that we all wanted to have. And in the end, we all gather around it, and we're all warmed by it, and we enjoy it, and we find it a focal point for so much of what feels like the goodness of life in that moment together. And when we stop and think about it, doesn't it feel kind of ridiculous to quarrel about how the fire got made? It feels like scrapping about how to make the fire represents this enormous loss of perspective, this kind of loss of our place in the story. We want a fire. We're making this analogous now, remember? We want a fire. We want an encounter with God. We know, if we stop to think about it at all, that God is not the kind of being that's going to stay contained in our little metaphoric fire pit and just provide us what we want on all occasions. God's not some genie where we rub this bottle and, you know. And yet, there are times where that happens too. And we pray like we did tonight. We do that partly because we know there are times where that is how this seems to go. Where God and all of God's essence and mysteriousness and dynamic will be a comfort to us and will be warmth to us and security and provision. But then there's another time where either God appears to be a conflagration or to at least not contain the essence of his power in a way that would stop the conflagration, right? Something happens and there's this roaring revelation of something that we can't handle. So it's important to try to keep our perspective, I think. It's important to try to remember that when we seek God, like when we seek fire, we are asking for, we are looking for more than we know. And maybe we shouldn't be surprised that God comes to us and flex and hints an arm here, a leg there. We couldn't stand in the face of the whole thing. And what might constrain God to the little fire pits of our lives, anyway? It's a bigger question, I think, one to explore for the rest of our lives, but doesn't it make sense that the only thing that's big enough and mysterious enough and dynamic enough to constrain that kind of power to that kind of need or space would be something that was also dynamic and mysterious and powerful, you know, something like love? Why would we spend so much time and energy, as we seem to do in the world of religion, scrapping about how to build the fire, when what we have in common is the desire to sit by it and be warmed? Maybe it's because that scrapping helps to foster or to maintain the delusion that we're in control of what we seek. But how in the name of God does that get us to, if you don't build the fire my way, what you have really isn't a fire at all? I think Which is not, by the way, to make the argument that there's no relative merits to this way of building a fire or that way of building a fire. We're talking about essence here. I think that Amy Newman, I think that this poet does something brilliant when she speculates about what would happen if she saw a video of the revelation of the sacred. And I just read the whole thing once and it roars by. But listen to this. She's talking about how Teresa of Avila might have done a better job of convincing people. It's good to see you, man. Yeah. Feel free. Peace. That Teresa of Avila would have done a better job of convincing the doubters if she'd been able to take a video with her phone, you know, and say, look, here he is. Here's the sacred. But still, Newman writes, I would have loved to have seen it. And maybe to know for certain would eliminate doubt or wonder. Maybe to have seen the captured, replayed video of the sacred would have eliminated doubt, would have given, as Newman said at the beginning of the poem, given her, how does she put it, it's lovely, to know the world's inner workings in a language unencumbered by doubts. Maybe it would have accomplished that. But I think she's brilliant when she also says the odds are pretty good that it would have eliminated wonder too. And I, for one, I don't know that this needs to be universal in any way, but I, for one, would rather live with flex and hints that point to wonder and the possibilities that go with that than live with certainty and a version of the thing called fire that is only and always within my control. So that's what I did with my summer vacation. Yeah, you did.